Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Marina Gibson is an ambassador for Orvis, the Angling Trust, and the Atlantic Salmon Trust. In June 2019, she launched the Northern Fishing School at Swinton Estate in North Yorkshire, where her and her team teach fly fishing while connecting as many people as possible to the great outdoors. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss finding a home base, why working in fishing can feel so exhausting, growing pains, and more.
I was born in London, and then when I was 2 years old, we moved to a place called the Cotswolds, which is sort of in the countryside, but 2 hours away from London.
Why the move?
I think my parents, I mean, my dad, he always worked in London, but I think both of them were originally from the countryside. They grew up there, and I think they were just ready to move to the countryside, especially having young children as well.
Did fishing start with your parents? Did they fish?
Yeah, so my family love fishing, and we did it a lot when we were younger, but it wasn't necessarily something that my brother and I were obsessed with. Like some kids I meet today and they're so obsessed. They've got social media channels and they're like 12 years old. And yeah, okay, maybe their parents, you know, run the channel for them, but they are so obsessed. Some kids have like thousands of followers already. It's amazing. But for us, I think it was just a lifestyle. We didn't have a choice. We were just going fishing because our parents loved it so much, especially my mom.
Isn't it really expensive in the UK? Every time I think about fishing, I automatically associate it with, you know, salmon fishing, Atlantic salmon fishing. But that's not the case over there, is it? Is carp fishing a big deal?
We've got everything, really. That's why it's so accessible over here. We've got carp fishing. Carp fishing is huge in the UK, and coarse fishing. And we have, obviously, salmon fishing. A lot of that is based in Scotland, but we obviously have other rivers in England where you can also fish, and also Ireland. There's lots of salmon fishing everywhere, although it's getting tougher and tougher, like you know, especially in England. And sometimes some rivers in Scotland are struggling. So we have a lot of still waters as well. Still water fisheries are extremely popular and a really great way of getting into fishing. They're very accessible. They're almost a stone throw away from everyone, wherever they live. You don't need much kit. You don't need waders. You can just turn up, you know, with a very, very basic rod and just learn how to cast. And it's just a nice, yeah, easy, accessible fishing or fishery from here. And also we have coastal fishing, which is free. You don't need a license. So you can just go, you know, catch sea bass, pollock, any wrasse as well, lots of species of wrasse. So we have an array of fish that we can catch, and some are expensive and others are cheaper.
What's the most expensive fish over there?
I would say Atlantic salmon or the river test. I'm sure you've heard of the river test, but this is pretty expensive. But I would say in some places, you know, in Scotland, you can be paying a lot of money to go salmon fishing, but you could also pay a lot of money to fish some of our chalk streams in the south of England as well.
Got it. Well, I've got more questions about the fishing, but let's come back to you here for a bit. So growing up, what?
I'll just ask you one question. Have you been fishing in the UK ever?
No, I have not been there.
You need to
yet.
Change this.
I've never even, I think I flew through there, England once. I landed for, there was like an hour of crazy frantic rushing. I think I was on my way. Yeah, I was on my way to the Seychelles and I landed somewhere over there. But no, I've never even stepped off an airplane. I've never been out your way.
Oh, you need to change this.
We can change it. It's on my list. It's definitely on my list. And it's totally accessible. It's not like it's not like it's that hard to get over to where you guys are at. So growing up, were you into at the outdoors or did that come later in life?
I was obsessed with animals and my horses. I had a pony since I was, I think I started riding since I was like 3 years old or something. And I rode a lot and I had a lot of animals as well. So I basically spent my whole time outside with my animals and looking after them. And even when we were inside, we had a lot of dogs and we had a cat and we used to, my parents used to, if they heard of any puppies that had been abandoned or something, or the mother had died during birth, we would take the puppies and we would have them. And I remember one time my dog Muffin, she lost all her puppies. So we found puppies that had lost their mom and we put them on her. And then we had these Basset hounds, which was so sweet. And yeah, so lots of animals.
It's funny to hear you say that you love animals because like you, I was obsessed with animals and the thought of an animal hurting. I mean, we used to drive by a squirrel that would be killed on the road and I'd have to have like an hour of silence. And so it was always very confusing to me when people would say, you can't love animals if you're into fishing and hunting, but let's focus specifically on fishing. Did you ever get that? Did you get people saying to you, well, how can you love animals and want to go hurt these poor fish in the water?
I actually get more grief online than offline. I don't think I've ever really met someone who in face-to-face who has actually said, why, how can you hook a fish? And, you know, if you love animals so much, but I do get the odd comment online, you know, from someone who doesn't understand it or someone who's an activist. But for me, it's all about conservation and it's all about how we all justify why we go fishing. And can you answer people with conservation background, why we do it, why we care so much and what goes back in, what do we give, you know? And a lot of it is if, you know, you have to ask the question, if we weren't around, if anglers weren't around, then who would really care for the fish? Because I'm pretty sure most of the people who don't go fishing don't really care about fish. The majority of people protecting the fisheries, not just the waterways, are people who fish. And that's not including kayakers and people who walk their dogs and wild swimmers. You know, this is becoming really popular in the UK. But for anglers, we really care about the aquatic fly life and the fish because it is a circle of life, you know. And that, for me, I can justify why I go fishing. And it is difficult because you are, at the end of the day, you know, putting a hook in a fish's mouth, right? And that's why I think for me, it's really important to always try and improve your catch and release techniques. Like I remember when I was younger, half of the time I killed what I caught.
I'm going to interrupt you because that's kind of where, that's where my brain was kind of, you know, lingering because As a kid, probably like you, it's not like you're saying, oh my gosh, I love animals. Now I want to go and catch this fish just to, you know, let it go. I think the reason why it was a natural progression or evolution back then is because you weren't looking at them in adornment, right? You were looking at them as food. So I'm assuming that you started off by taking your fish to bring home and eat.
Well, it depends what kind of mood I was in. So I remember we went on this big boat in out at sea and we were as a big family, I think there was another family there as well, and we were catching all sorts of things and we were putting them in these buckets, big buckets, and they were all going off to market. And each fish was just slammed in the buckets. And every time I looked down at the fish, they were all flapping about. And I said to my mom, I'm going to start putting these back. So I started putting each fish back into the ocean. And then when I was 11, I caught my first Atlantic salmon. And the gilly, normally you kill your first Atlantic salmon. It's like a celebration, a tradition. And the gilly asked me if I wanted to keep or release. And I released. But then I would, for example, I pretty much killed every single brown trout I ever caught when I was younger. And my way of thinking and my actions are definitely different and more, I would say, consistent now than I was when I was younger. But definitely, I didn't really think about it when I was younger because my parents would kill fish left, right, and center. You know, they would kill all their salmon they caught and they would fill their freezer. So we had salmon for the whole year. But now, obviously, that's changed massively. And, you know, Atlantic salmon in this country is pretty much going to all catch and release. I mean, most people are catch and release now.
Yeah. And again, we'll come back to that too later. So you're growing up, you move to the country, you're a pretty normal kid, you love animals, and you're fishing with your family here and there. Does that have me pretty caught up?
Yes.
So when do you start going fishing solo, taking it on as your thing and not a family thing?
So we fished as a family and up until the age of about 11. And then when I was 11, my parents separated. And that's when from 11 years old to probably 20, 21, my mom and I would go fishing together. And actually, since then, I haven't really gone fishing with my dad. Not that we wouldn't love to. It's just something that we didn't carry on together, like my mom and I. And then I left when I was 18. I moved to New Zealand for a couple of years, random. But I basically took a year off, and the first stop was New Zealand. And I was like, I'm not leaving. I'm staying here. This is really fun. So I stayed, and I lived near a river, and I started sort of, I think we had a spinner, and I started chucking my spinner out, but this is as far as it goes. And then when I came back to London, I moved into a flat, and I went to uni out in New Zealand. So I did my first year of uni out there. And then I transferred back to uni in London for my second and third year. It was all quite complicated. But when I was in London, I don't know whether I was looking for something, an escape or something to save me, because at the time I was very unsettled. I was really unbalanced. I was kind of, I don't know, every weekend would repeat itself. I would go out with friends. And then, I don't know what happened, but when I was 21, my parents, my dad said, okay, I'm going to get you a nice present. That's the last nice, you know, big present you'll get. And I think traditionally my mom said, okay, well, why don't you get some jewelry? And I thought about it for a while. So it was months after my 21st, and I still hadn't decided. And then I honestly can't tell you when it was. Maybe it was I went to a fishing fair, maybe I went to the game fair, but something made me ask my dad and my mom for my own rods. So they had obviously had, they've got loads of rods. We had used them on our family trips, but I had never had my own. So this is when I got given my first trout and salmon rod. Whilst I was living in London, I think I got my first car. So I now had a car, and that meant that I could go fishing by myself. So I asked around and talked to people and asked them where the nearest fishery was, where I could get started. Because the thing is when you fish with your parents for that long, you become so dependent on them for everything, for you know, time on flies or casting. And you have, you know, most of the time we would be salmon fishing, so we'd always have a gilly. So if you got, you know, stuck in a tree, the gilly would help, or your mom would help, or my dad would help. So this was really a time where I had to learn a lot very, very quickly. And I went to Zion Park, which was about 20 minutes away from where I lived in London. And I just started casting. And this was just it kind of looks like, it's a still water, but it looked like a river. It was really long and it kind of went on for about a mile, I think. And it was just stocky trout. And so I just started catching, you know, some weekends I would blank, other weekends I would catch fish. And if I caught a fish, I'd go back and I'd be seeing friends that evening. So I'd give them a fish as a present, instead of like, you know, like a housewarming gift or a house party gift. People would bring like booze. I would just bring the fish. Yeah. And then I started going further afield. I started sort of going to bigger still waters. I remember I turned up at Grafham and I didn't know how to drive a boat. And I asked them whether there was anyone who could take me out. And there was this old guy, and I can't remember his name, but he took me out. And it was so nice, especially on entry level by yourself, just having people like, and you'll know this, there are a lot of people out there who will help you, which is so great for beginners, because a lot of the time I think if you turn up to a fishery and you see someone struggling, you would, yeah, most people anyway would help. From that stage, I just was so obsessed. And I think I became obsessed because it saved me from, it challenged me, and it also filled a void, filled something for me that was missing. And yeah, I think, you know, I wasn't in a great place. And then suddenly fishing was my everything, and that's all I wanted to do. So I put in a lot of time and effort to perfect casting, although obviously you can never perfect it because you can always be better. But, you know, I remember there was a guy at Zion who walked up to me and he said, you'll be good in a year. I'm like, okay, thanks. Like he meant, you know, really well. And he was really encouraging, but you know, that kind of comment makes you laugh. 5 years later, you think, wow, okay. I certainly put in the effort and I deserve that comment now. So yeah. And then it just grew from that.
How long ago was that then? 10 years ago.
That was 10 years ago. Yeah.
It's crazy. Funny, because I feel like you were on my radar 10 years ago then. I wonder if you were on my radar pretty early within your entry to the sport. Because hang on.
I mean, yeah, to be honest.
Maybe about 8 years ago. Does that sound right?
Yeah, probably. I can't remember. I think I would have started posting in around 2013. So yeah, that actually makes sense.
Gotcha.
But when I started, because social media and fishing was, social media came after, but when I was fishing and posting stuff just for fun, it wasn't something that I was doing because I knew that there was an industry and I knew that I could, you know, build on this and try and get a job in as a fisherwoman or, you know, angler, because for me that didn't exist. I didn't, you know, it was just, I was just posting trout just for fun because I was so obsessed with it at that time. And you would have been probably there from the start of when I actually came back into fishing. So you would have been one of my inspirations from day one.
Oh, it's so cool because it's such a small world, even though it's so far away, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then where did you end up going from there? So you're posting on social. I thought I remembered you almost immediately getting into teaching casting. So what's the next step in your journey?
So after I'd done a lot of stocky bashing, we call it stocky bashing in the UK. Do you call it stocky bashing too?
No, but I have heard that.
So after I'd done a lot of that, and I was doing salmon fishing. I would do salmon fishing once a year with my mum every year. And then Then I did my Angling Trust Level 1 exam. So I reached out to a couple of people to ask them how I improve and, you know, are there any exams out there? Someone must have mentioned it. And so I researched it a little bit. And so I did my Angling Trust Level 1 coaching exam. And this wasn't something I did just because I wanted a job. I actually just wanted to improve and see where it took me. But at the time I took my Level 1, I wasn't that confident. So I decided.
What is this Level 1? It's not through the Federation of Fly Fishers, right?
No. So
is it the Europe thing or the, yeah, tell
what it is. It's basically they have Angling Trust is an organization who have, and I actually don't know when they started up the Level 1 and Level 2 coaching exams, but it's under the Angling Trust umbrella. And there's a Level 1 and Level 2, and it's all about coaching. It's not actually, there's not much casting. There's a little bit of casting and there's a little bit of teaching, but not the bulk of it is coaching and how to build rapport and how to be safe. So it's actually a really, really good starting point. For me, it was perfect because you can do a casting exam, but actually just to learn the health and safety and all the other things that you don't think about is really, really helpful. So, but again, at that time when I passed my Level 1, I thought I'd give it a few more years until I took my Level 2, just because, again, I didn't feel that confident at that time.
So you started with that. At that point, when you took that course, did you start thinking, I wouldn't mind teaching this or guiding or being involved professionally somehow? And where were you working at the time of all of this? Did you have a job or were you just a student at the time?
I was working in London. And my last job in London was I was working for a commercial property company, and I had the most awesome bosses, and they were really interested in the fact. They were like, "Are you going fishing again this weekend?" like always taking the piss, and they were really. I loved that job. I loved my bosses. They were really great, and but all I wanted to do was go fishing. And it's actually one of my regrets is that at the time, because I was so obsessed with fishing and all I wanted to do was go to the countryside, I didn't want to be in the city. And I really regret resenting London because I kind of put myself I sort of took myself out of London before I'd even left. So I didn't socialize as much. I mean, fishing pretty much ruined my social life. And I decided that I would take my Level 2 because I had met my boyfriend at the time and he wanted to leave London as well. So that suited me. And I was basically just getting ready to leave London. And I think actually at this time I'd already taken my Level 2. So I think I was actually getting ready because I had already done my Level 2, which meant I could, not legally because you can coach without your exams. But for me, especially as a woman in the sport, I wanted to take as many exams as possible so people could take me a little bit more seriously. So I took my Level 2 and then, and I didn't even know about the casting exams at this stage. I had no idea. Again, I think the industry is, when you're in it, it seems so small, but actually when you're outside it, there's so much to learn about it. And so when did I leave London? I actually don't know the year. I would have left London about 5 years ago, I think. I had taken my Level 2, left London, decided to leave my job, and see whether I could find a career in fishing.
Wait, 5 years ago, what did that look like? Oh, this is fascinating. What did that look like 5 years ago? Because I know when I decided to make that move, it was before social. And so, you know, when you wanted to make it a career, and like you, I had to look at making it a job and looking at it on paper and going, okay, I need to write X amount of articles. maybe sell some merchandise. I've got to do some guided trips. I need to teach this many classes and I need to speak for this many clubs. That was how I was going to map out my career. How did it look 5 years ago with this new world of technology?
I was endorsed by Orvis. The 2 years before I left London, I was with Orvis. So when I left, they supported me, which I'm forever grateful for. And then I started doing a few days on the test. And I was doing a few days up in North Yorkshire where we moved to. But to be honest, I was really struggling. I was struggling big time. And actually, I was struggling. I would probably say I was struggling for the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Sounds about difficult. Right. Yeah. And it's so funny I don't know about you, but I also struggled for the first 5 years. And within that 5 years, I'd grown a pretty big name for myself. And people were like, oh, yeah, well, she's bawling. I mean, I remember seeing video or comments on videos and they'd be like, must be nice to be rich. And meanwhile, I'm like selling things on my house at garage sales to try to make a living. And then one night it did honestly flip. It really, truly switched and all my hard work paid off. And that's a different story for another day. But how did it feel having people looking at you, assuming that you had all were successful and doing well? Meanwhile, you know, you're struggling to make ends meet.
So I can actually relate really well to what you just said. And this year just gone was the first year since I've given up everything to do fishing.
Five years? Did it take you 5 years?
5 years. This season was the first season that I've actually put money into my savings after 5 years.
Yeah, it's a long 5 years too. I don't think people who have done it understand how hard it is, but that I want people to understand, because people reach out to me all the time. They reach out to friends of mine all the time. They probably reach out to you all the time saying, I want to quit my job and I want to make a living at this. And you don't want to discourage them, but you want them to understand that this does not happen overnight. I mean, everybody knows a good investment, I think the return on an investment should be, well, it depends on the investment, but I know the investments I looked at, if I haven't been making a profit within 3 years, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about moving forward. So a five year investment to finally start to see any profit is it's a long old commitment, and it's got to be something you really love. Obviously, we're not in it to become rich and famous, but yeah, it's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a long time, and it's really stressful. It was super stressful. You go up and down, you have good days and you have bad days. And actually I received a comment on one of my photos the other day. And actually we can develop what I'm just about to say later. But he said, be nice if you fished where us mere mortals did, day ticket reservoirs, etc. I'm like, firstly, that's where I came from. Secondly, I don't have time to go fishing just for myself. I was saying the other day to Stefan, I was saying, I think this season, the first season where I have been able to put savings into my account, is the first season where I feel like I've lost myself a little bit. I have lost my path. I've lost why I do it. That's why I think I need to have a break. I need to go and find that again, find the love for it and do it for myself, not for everything else. And it's so easy to just get caught up in everything and forget, you know, what makes it so exciting for you.
Yeah, that's really important. Nip that in the butt now. Even if it's a project, sometimes the best thing you can do is just take on your own project. Or for me, that project was buying a little piece of land and then turning that into my, you know, my little homestead. Because then at least that way you've got something for you and you can still work around it. There's all sorts of ways to monetize various projects, but nip that in the butt while you can. But it's funny, those comments about being a mare, you know, being like a quote unquote normal angler. It's just so offensive and just shows how disconnected some people are. But unfortunately, in the fly fishing industry, there are certain people who do get to bypass all of that and just immediately hop onto fancy trips. But But it's, yeah, anyway, we'll save that for another day.
Yeah, I think going back to the fishing, why you do it and what, you know, why we love it. I guess it's really difficult to juggle everything all at once. And I think the main reason why I haven't been fishing at home so much is because I do my trip. Let's say I go to, for example, I've gone to Russia. Then when I get back, I have so much to catch up on that I don't fish for the next 2 months. Yes, so not even to my local reservoirs, or, you know, it's, and, you know, with lots of different businesses and things that you're doing, it's so difficult to then take your, you know, I don't even have weekends anymore because you just work through, especially when you don't have a family, you can just work, you know, without anyone sort of saying to you, you know, okay, hello, there's me, I need some attention. So it's really easy to get carried away with it all. That's why I have to take a step back right now.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, before we talk about taking a step back, let's talk about when you were taking your steps forward. So you start guiding. Where's the next step in your evolution?
Then, okay, so I think the Northern Fishing School came in, this is our third season. So that's I was at a stage where I was doing a little bit of guiding here and a little bit of guiding there. And I really needed a base. I needed a place where people could come to me instead of me traveling everywhere, because I was going up to Scotland, down south, to the east, to the west. I was going everywhere. And because I didn't have a base, I was going to people instead of the people coming to me. So this is when I was going around. I was looking on Google Maps where I live. I was going onto Google Maps and I was trying to find a lake where I could base myself, because I was catering mainly for beginners. And I think at this stage, I had passed my FFI exam. So I had done my CI. I was a qualified single-handed casting instructor. And so things for me were, you know, I had more confidence. And that's when I was like, okay, I need a base for myself. And I was going on Google Maps and I was trying to find lakes, and I would literally turn up to people's like houses and businesses being like, are you using this lake? And there were a couple of people who were like, okay, it sounds interesting, but obviously this mad crazy fisherwoman was trying to take over the lake. So a lot of people were saying, actually, it's not vacant. This is our business. We do weddings and it would be disturbing us. And then I came, I hadn't found a lake yet, but I did have a meeting with Swinton Hotel, which they were very close to where I lived. And they're a hotel, they've got lots of facilities and lots of activities as well. So at the time, no one was running their fishing. So it was vacant. And I asked if I could start corporate events with them on there. I actually don't think it was even the lake, it was on the river. So I was going to bring maybe six people, take them salmon fishing or trout fishing and have a picnic. And it was with the hotel owner, the managing director, and I think someone else, and I can't remember. And it was a very intimate meeting, but at the time I was quite nervous because I wasn't established. I was just taking a punt. I was just asking people basically to help me. And the owner of Swinton Hotel, he said, okay, what's your plan? And I said, well, I want to start up the Northern Fishing School. And I just need a lake for beginners mainly, just to get them into fishing, and then we can take them to the river. And he was like, well, I've got loads of lakes. You can, you know, pick your favorite one. So that was that. I basically went around all of his lakes, found the one which was most appropriate, which is right next to the hotel, really easy access, and quite small as well, which is for me perfect for beginners, especially kids and you know, even people with accessibility issues. People could go into this premises really, really easily. So the Northern Fishing School was born literally from that meeting 2 months later. I had 2 months to get it ready before the season. We did all the graphic design and marketing, the logos, everything happened within that time frame. And we had a big launch and we invited lots of people, lots of kids and a few local people just to spread the word. And we had a couple of newspapers cover it. And that was really it. And that was the first season. And I think we actually started a little bit late. We started in June. And the following season was COVID. So we also started in June. And the following this year, I think it was delayed again because of COVID. But still, we've had our main – this season has been our longest one. And I think what's really great, especially like looking at statistics, you'll know in the first year, I think we taught 60 people. Then it went up to 150 in our second year. And then we've done more than 400 people this year, just gone. And I don't know whether that's COVID, and touch wood, it's not.
Oh, that is amazing. How many instructors do you have? And are they just there for the day? Like, tell us more about the school.
So now we have four guides and they are part-time. One of them is actually pretty much full-time. He does, most weeks he'll do 5 days a week. So we have Benny, who started right from the start. He came in, he's a ski instructor in Verbier in Switzerland, and he's born on the slopes and he loves fishing. And he came to me literally knocking on my door being like, I love fishing. I want to be a guide. Can you help me? And this was when I was literally just starting up the Northern Fishing School. So I didn't actually need an extra pair of hands, but I was like, you know what? You are a really cool guy. Yes. So he started with me from the beginning. And then we have Brian Towers, who's our highest qualified guide and instructor with AAP Guy. And he's been with us from the start as well. And then we've just recruited a new guy called Ben Fox, who is great. He's really young, very enthusiastic, and works with children with disadvantages. And he's just the perfect candidate for the school. And the thing that's what's so great as well is that we have these different personalities. So we match people depending on we match people with the guides depending on their personalities and ability and experience and needs. And then we also have a guy called Charlie Brownlow, who again is fairly, I mean, he lives a little bit further away, so he has to come down, and sometimes he has to come 2 hours just to guide for the day and go all the way back up if we can't find another guide. So it's not ideal for him, but he is really loving it. And especially he's kind of come in at the start of his journey as well, because he hasn't been guiding for that long. So we've kind of taken him through the steps, and there's a certain way that I would say we teach. And this is all down to the fact that I did my casting exam with FFI and I learned so much. And I had this amazing mentor, Chris Haig, and also Shaker. But Chris, I spent a lot of time with during my prep. And his teaching method is, he's very, he thinks of everything. He uses a lot of props. His mannerisms and everything, the way that he teaches and makes people feel at ease, and also the way that he explains everything is just so clear and crisp. And so at the school, I've tried to take as much as what I've learned from FFI and taken it to the school, and how we also start, because actually, when we started in our first year at the school, I would say that I wasn't as experienced. I had taken my FFI, but I was still fairly new to it. So there are things where you look back and you think, oh man, I missed a trick, or oh, I'm so gutted that those people who came, I probably couldn't, I didn't give them as best services they could have got, and you think, damn. But you live and you learn and you actually improve all the time. And I think at the beginning of when we started, I don't think we did as much grass work with our clients as we do now. So we would just take people straight onto the lake, or we would take people straight onto the river. But now grass comes first. We make people, you know, sometimes let's say people are coming for a 4-hour session and they're a beginner. Sometimes we spend 2 hours on the grass. And if it's a full day, 8 hours, we could spend half a day on the grass doing activities, because I would rather people come to the school and let's say they're a beginner and they want to experience on the lake. For catching a fish, for me, is the last thing that they, you know, it's like the cherry on top. We want them to go away, say, you know, if someone asks, how is your fishing? We want them to say, we learned so much, now we can go and do it, as opposed to, we caught so much, oh, I don't know how to tie this knot, or oh, I don't know how to cast, or, you know. And these grass steps are so crucial, because we take people from right from the start, right from the grassroots, and then we give them the confidence so that when they leave, they can do that all by themselves. And I think that's what we missed out on the first year. But again, you live and you learn.
It hurts looking back, doesn't it? I mean, I physically blush when I think of lessons or some of the demonstrations at trade shows. Oh, I still have some that make me want to just lay down and die. Or old pieces of writing that you read now and you're like, how did this ever pass an editor? I mean, but the thing is if you let it stop you, then everybody will just think that that was your maximum potential. So you almost have to just keep improving to show yourself and others that you're learning, right?
I feel exactly the same.
You're like, if I stop now, then you guys are going to think that's the best I've got. Damn it, I've got to keep working my ass off.
And I think that's why it's really sad to see that when someone, and I know because I've felt it, and I've felt that firsthand, where you put something out there and you open yourself up, and then you hear people or you see people sort of ripping you apart. And yeah, it's difficult, and it's very easy to do it yourself, you know. But I try and sort of, because I know how it feels, and I think it is changing. You'll see this, that it, you know, the industry and the community is changing. They are being more acceptable, I think, most of the time.
It feels like it. But again, it's been so long since I was, you know, a quote unquote rookie, that I don't know if it's just that people are treating me differently because anyone who's tried to break my knees has already done it, or if it's just that society has changed as a whole. With your school and the trips, and because I don't know if you're like me, but do you look at your career as two parts? You've almost got yourself, the person, as one brand, and then you've got your company as another brand, right? And both of those brands are full-time jobs trying to manage, because there's a lot of administration and administrative work that goes into them. I know who will manage you, the person, but the school, who's doing all the administrative work with that? Is that also you?
Okay, so I was doing it up until now. So for the first 2 years, I was doing it all by myself. I was doing the invoicing, the emails, and we were still doing quite a few people, but it was not as busy as this season just gone. And it was crazy. I spent a lot of nights just working until 12 or 1 o'clock, because if I didn't get that done, and because I was also guiding a lot, then as soon as I came off the water, I was emailing, and I wouldn't go to sleep until the early hours of the morning trying to catch up. So that's when at the beginning of the season's just gone, I decided I need someone to help me with my admin. I guided probably half as much as I did in the first 2 years, just because I can't be on the water and also run the businesses as well. Because otherwise, and still I have nights where I work until 1 o'clock, because I just have to, you know, get it done. But I have admin help now, which has changed my life. It's amazing, especially for the school. I do my all my own stuff, but for the school, this season has been so crazy that if I had been doing the admin, I think I would have quit altogether.
Yeah, because if you're putting through that many students, that's a lot of emails, and then you're invoicing, you're trying to coordinate schedules. Are they able to stay at the hotel? Do you do overnight trips at the school?
Yeah, so the hotel has the main hotel, and then it also has bivouacs. So it has yurts and log cabins. So it has everything for everyone, basically, and all different price points as well. So it is, it's a great estate. It's amazing. And there's just so much to do there as well. It's not just fishing. You can go clay shooting or horse riding or go and see the birds of prey. There's loads of stuff going on.
Why do you think having a career in fly fishing is so exhausting? I have a couple ideas, but I'd like to hear your ideas.
That's a really good question. I think there's a few sides to it. I think that the first one is, if you're working for yourself in the fishing industry, you have to bring in so many different things to make it work. So, I mean, for example, you could depend on a brand or a company, which actually is easier because then you get your 2 days off or your days off to go and have a breather, go and fish for yourself, and or spend time with family and friends. But if you work for yourself, for some reason, it just takes up all your time. And I've heard on the grapevine that that's why so many relationships and marriages fail, because I can't put my finger on it, but you have to work so many extra hours and you are so immersed in everything. You have to know your stuff. You have to read the books, you have to write articles, or you have to guide, or you have to, you know, learn about the river whilst you're not guiding. There's so much to do. And there's also emails and communication with people, and it eats up all your time. Right? Since I've been doing this for 5 years, the last 5 years have gone so quickly. But I honestly feel like I haven't actually had a rest. I've had like the odd trip, which feels like half a holiday, but half work. So, you know, it just zaps all your energy. And I don't know why. Maybe you know.
Well, I have a couple of theories. I think the exhaustion starts because you love being outside. And so there's almost like this cutoff point in the day, and that's when the sun goes down. So you're trying to use the day as much as you can, because for one of two reasons: either you love it and you just want to be out there doing it, or you're trying to become better and more knowledgeable, right? So you're chewing up all this time and counting down for the night. And then if you're doing it professionally, that's when your second job starts, right? So, you know, when I was guiding, especially saw it as two parts of my workday. I had my 8 hours of light. That was my first part of my job. And then I had my 8 hours of administration, which was my second part, the second part of my job. And then I think another big part of it is the pressure. There's this pressure in our heads of, if this doesn't work and I'm living my dream, because, you know, there's all this hype, right? You're living your dream, you're doing what you love. The media gets involved in, you know, there's newspaper articles. So-and-so is doing what she loves and made a dream job. There's this pressure of, if this doesn't work, there's nothing else I can do. What else am I going to do? Right. So I think that pressure is exhausting. And then reputation, and some anglers and guides and personalities just don't care. And they're the ones that you get to read all the fun stories about on the forums and on social media. But I think we care about our reputation. So there's a lot of being on. So, you know, when I didn't care, and I was always nice, but if I ran into someone on the river and I knew that I was losing hours and I had to go in and get stuff done, I would say to them, look, I've got to go. Whereas now I have to be on a lot more. So there's a lot more smiling, a lot more listening, a lot more time chewed up being pleasant. So by the time that you factor in your reputation and any sorts of pressure, and then the daylight being lost, then also the two parts of the job, and there's also the pressure of seasons, right? So it's like, oh my gosh, I only have 5 months to make it rain. So I think we're just built to burn ourselves out.
Yeah. And I think that I'm hoping last off season. So our main season is from April to October. We're actually opening all year round, but I always will leave for winter somewhere, whether it's Europe or whether it's further afield. But I hope that, because last year we were all locked in and that was my time to get away and release and go fishing for myself. And to be fair, we did a lot of winter fishing, but you know, we did 21 days straight in Rügen, which is the Baltic coast, and we were wading in like 3-degree weather and it was so cold. And I remember the last few days I was like, this is the first time I've not enjoyed fishing. I just want to enjoy my life again. Please, can we go home? It was so damn cold. And so this, I hope that from how I feel right now and how sort of snowed in I am, I hope that by going away, I can sort of revamp and then come back with a fresh mind, because I think it is important. I think if you are a guide or you're doing seasonal work, I think it's so, because it is intense. It's so intense because it's a season. It's not all year round. You know, you have to, like you said, make hay whilst the sun shines. So it's important to get away, even if it doesn't have to be for, you know, months on end, but just to have that break away from something and refresh everything is so important.
Yeah. It's all coming back to me now, guiding. I remember guiding at the end of the season and all of us just hated it. Not the guiding, but we just wanted some time off to be able to sleep. So all sorts of reasons to be tired. Now I know, speaking of being tired, that it's getting late there. What time is it in the UK?
It is 11:45.
Okay, so we're going to let you get ready to finish up some packing. You're not flying out tomorrow, are you?
No, I'm flying in about a week.
Okay, good. I'd like to hit you up with some quick tips and tricks. I noticed on your website, you've got this wonderful blog post about on grass casting. You've got a triangle drawing. Can you tell me what that exercise is so people can try it at home?
Okay, so for beginners. Mm-hmm. So if you were to build a triangle with those cones, you stand on the point of the cone and then you look out to your left cone and your right cone. So we start ground up. So we talk about footwork, we talk about how you hold your rod, what different grips are. And then basically, if you think about it, if you see, I always say, river runs through it, how Brad Pitt is casting back and forward. This is the overhead cast. So the first stages of this would be that if you imagine that your back stop and your forward stop is creating a V in up above, off your right-hand shoulder or your left-hand shoulder, depending on whether you're right-handed or left-handed. So you've got this V, which is your casting arc. Now your casting arc is this triangle. So you've got your back stop and you've got your forward stop. So your back stop, if you're going over your right hand shoulder, would be your right cone, and your left cone would be your forward stop. So what you do is you lay the line down and then you want to accelerate to that other cone and stop, and just lay the line down. And this is a good exercise for timing as well, and just to feel the stops and see the line straighten. So you do this a few times and you get comfortable, and your line should be, when you stop, your line should be going out nice and straight. So you have your straight fly line straight to your tapered leader, to your fly. So a nice straight line. And you keep repeating this and just laying the line down every time you come back to that stop and forward to that stop. Now then you can climb the ladder. So you want to get up to this overhead beautiful casting that Brad Pitt was doing. So you want to climb the ladder. So you can then tilt the trajectory of your casting arc a little bit up. So now you'll be side casting and you'll be going a little bit faster because you don't want to tick. Ticking is when you touch the ground grass when you're with your fly, when you're going back and forward. So now you're going back stop, forward stop, and you're still stopping on the left and right hand cone. Okay, so you've still got these stops and you've got the cones to mark at these stops, And then eventually you'll get up over your head. So, but with fishing, I mean, this is a good exercise as well, because you'll be doing some side casting and some overhead casting. So it's a good exercise to start with, because it kind of shows you that you can, your casting arc is on a pivot. You can do side casting. You can tilt it forwards or tilt it backwards. Yeah, I hope I explained that okay, because
you did. And I'll also link it in the show notes. So on the website, we've got show notes, and I'll be sure to link this, because I think it's an excellent post.
I thought about something the other day, because I think, again, like you said, there's so much pressure in the industry. And when you put yourself out there, you have to always grow. And at the school, I feel like it's my duty to think of new things that we can do to improve our classes. And the other day, I was thinking of something really cool that I'm going to start up this season. You know how you go to the gym and you have circuits? So you do circuits, you do these weights, you know, you do, I don't know, dumbbells, or I don't know what else, like what else?
Bench pressing, squats.
Bench pressing. Yeah, exactly. As you can tell, I'm not much of a gym geek. But what I thought was, is we, because we do so much grass work, we have this big grass area, which is near the lake, and the grass is nice and short, so we can cast with yarn on the end of the line and it doesn't get stuck. And so I thought of doing this circuit. So you go from one exercise to the next. So you have maybe a tracking exercise, and you have this triangle exercise, and you have all these exercises. So you can have people just going around, and you have like 10 exercises. And I think for me, it's a way of trying to get people to work together as a team, talk about it. And there's always things that you can do and improve as a tutor and as a guide. And this is just one of the things that I thought about, and maybe it will help other people as well. But just some fun exercises, because you know when you do, you know when you go somewhere and you're learning a new skill, exercises can be really fun. So yeah, I'll let you know how those go.
Before we wrap it up, right at damn near almost midnight, is there anything that really glaringly obvious that I've missed as far as your life or your career goes?
I would say I would like to highlight the charity that we've just launched.
So yes, please. What's that?
It's called Cancer in Pisces, and it basically started with a guy called Mick May. He wrote a book called Cancer in Pisces. And Quilla published the book, and they sent me an email to see whether I would review the book. So they sent me a copy. I read the book, and a man I'd met a few years before, he had come to one of my fishing free events in London, and he said he had prostate cancer, and he was trying to find a cancer charity that would allow him to go fishing and just get out there and, you know, find that haven and try and escape what he was going through. And he couldn't find anything. And I know that Casting for Recovery is out there, and it's incredible, and the stuff that they do is amazing. And it started in the US, didn't it? Yeah. And it's everywhere now, right?
Yeah, I think so. Or spreading pretty rapidly.
Yeah. So this came into my mind when I read the book. So I decided I would reach out to Mick and see whether he, because we have the venue at the school, I thought that we could use it as a pilot venue to see whether it would work. And what the idea would be, what the idea is that we offer free fishing centers to cancer sufferers, and they can bring a companion with them too. So once a month we open up for one day, and we have two sessions of 4 hours and a picnic in between. So the first, a lot of people come in the morning, they have picnic with the arrivals of the second session. And so it's basically from Mick. I haven't actually spoken much about the book, which is the most important thing, because it is the inspiration. Mick has a very rare cancer from asbestos being in an office where they were doing some work, and the asbestos, he was sitting, you know, very, very close to this work, and that's how he came in contact with the asbestos. And so he was given, I think he was given a year to live, and he's on his 13th. I hope I got that right. Wow. As soon as I picked up the phone, I knew that this was destined to happen. Because he was so kind. He was so accommodating. He wanted to know more. And so basically from then on, we've been working on this project, and we've just recently launched, and we've got an amazing team of trustees, and we bring in our different credibilities, different experiences. So now we've launched, we will have our first free, and by the way, the membership, basically on our website, we have membership. So people can sign up for a free membership. They can also sign up for a free membership plus a book, Mick May's book. So I think this is £15. And this is all life membership as well, so they don't have to pay every year. And then they can also donate if they want to. So they can then have access to all our fishing centers, which are free. And we only have to raise. So the whole idea in the beginning was that it was low cost, high impact. So we weren't paying anyone salary. So none of the trustees are paid a salary. We only pay a small admin cost to an administrator, and also our guides. We pay our guides for their day, for their service. And so it is very low cost. We don't have to raise that much money, and we will be doing free fishing monthly fishing centers from May till October. And so it is seasonal, and then it closes for winter, and then it comes back in May. And it's just it is our first one is in May 2022. So we're getting ready for that. And it is really exciting. And also because, you know, we have the venue already, so we might as well offer something to, you know, help people and, you know, see where it takes us. Because if we raise enough money, then we'll be able to start up a new pilot somewhere else as well. So we'll be heading south, I think, first.
How exciting. Well, I'm excited to watch what you do in the next decade or two. Before we wrap it up and let you go to bed, is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
What other trips do you, I have a lot of questions for you, by the way. What other trips do you have on your bucket list?
Well, now that I can't die, they've changed, but they're still there. So Russia, there's some stuff I wouldn't mind getting down to the Congo just to experience that. That's something I've always wanted to experience. Yeah. More British Columbia.
BC.
Yeah, I want to fish for Nile perch. That's way up there. Oh, New Guinea black bass. So I really, really, really want to go to New Guinea. And that won't be far off. I'll do that trip in the next couple of years. But British Columbia. Yeah, yeah. But like all the stuff where I live. You know what the problem is splitting the year. Well, being in Canada and being in Australia, there's so many places that I want to visit in both those countries that I just don't – I need to make time for. I suspect that you and I will have lots to talk about in future.
Let's meet up somewhere for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think we should do Canada, or I'll come to you in the UK, because that's definitely doable. Perfect. All right. Before we wrap it up, is there anything else that you really wanted to add, or should we let you get some sleep?
I think that's it. Thank you so much. Honestly, I was so nervous. I was like, should I have some alcohol? I was like, I'm so nervous. Should I drink to relax myself? And honestly, I've really enjoyed this. So thank you so much. And you just keep smashing it. And
thank you.
I'm just really honored to be on here. I feel like I actually haven't deserved a place on here. So I feel very honored right now.
Well, I have a dirty little secret here too. I like to get some of you guys, those who have mega potential, I like to get to you guys while you're still young, because I hope to be able to do this again in 20 years and look back and kind of giggle and see how far you've come.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I will share all of the links that we spoke about in the show notes. And hopefully we can fish together at some point in the future.
Yes.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.